It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what are the most effective ways to counter the phenomenon of violent extremism? This was the topic of a recent White House summit, and what U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says is the preeminent challenge of the 21st century. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. U.S. President Barack Obama issued a call to action to confront the challenge of violent extremism last year at the 2014 U.N. General Assembly in New York. He asked all countries to do more to address this challenge, which emanates primarily but not exclusively from the Muslim world. Speaking at the summit last week, President Obama said that we are here because of the urgent threat from groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, and that we are focused on preventing these groups from radicalizing, recruiting, or inspiring others to violence in the first place, unquote. Participants from about 60 countries attended the White House summit and were supposed to have identified the drivers of violent extremism and develop effective interventions against them. The summit was also to serve as a platform where governments, non-governmental actors, civil society, and the private sector could announce the concrete steps they intend to take leading up to the 2015 United Nations General Assembly and beyond to stem the spread of violent extremism. World leaders will convene to review the progress made over the next 7 months at the 2015 UN General Assembly meeting. Well, for more on the outcome and implications of the summit, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Paul Piller is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, formerly a longtime analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. And Benjamin Haddad, he's research fellow in European and transatlantic affairs at the Hudson Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Paul Piller, let me start with you. I'd like to get your take on the summit. To what extent do you think the participants met their goals, identifying the so-called drivers of extremism and effective ways of countering this threat?
Well, I don't think there were any expectations either by the U.S. organizers or by the foreign participants that this gathering would mark new departures or new agreements or anything significant in the way of that kind of output. I think the basic purposes of this gathering were, I would identify them as three. One, to make a statement about the overall importance of the topic and to reaffirm priority that the U.S. government gives to it. Number two was to emphasize the international dimension of it. This is not something that either the United States itself or any other one country, be it France, Denmark, or whoever, can tackle on its own, but international cooperation is of the very essence of trying to address the topic. And number three, to emphasize the multifaceted nature of the sorts of measures that need to be taken into account. We in the United States, in looking at the progress or the activities of a group like ISIS, tend to look at maps in our newspaper about who's gaining and losing control of towns or territory. But I think President Obama certainly wanted to make the statement that it's much more than that. It's partly a matter of the circumstances that lead individuals to be recruitable into an extremist group, and also in terms of the ideas and messages that are part of this battle of ideas. So it was all those things, and I guess you could say they moderately met those goals.
Let me turn to Benjamin Haddad for your take on the summit, the purpose, and then there was some controversy over semantics. Some critics of President Obama said that we need to identify the threat more specifically as violent extremism, but because it seems to be emanating from the Muslim world, particularly radical Islamists, that we should call the threat what it is. What are your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I agree with most of what was said. I mean, I don't think we could have expected any concrete deliverables or any kind of formal agreement coming out of this summit, and I don't think it was the goal in itself. One thing that can be regretted, though, is the very broad nature, I think that was the point maybe, but the very broad nature of this summit diluted certainly the message, the idea of making it a summit about violent extremism, which is a very broad, generic term, just a few weeks after two terrorist attacks, one in France, obviously, against Charlie Hebdo and Hyper-Cacher, and the other one in Denmark, which were directly linked to issues of Islamic radicalism and denounced as such by the authorities in Europe, made it a bit weird and maybe out of touch to just focus on a broader issue. Now, I do think, however, that it's useful to bring together experts, educators, people who work on prevention of radicalization, not so much, once again, to come out with concrete results, but just as a networking mechanism. A lot of methods can be shared. The mayor of Paris, for example, was in D.C. these last few days, and I'm sure exchanging with other mayors in the United States or in Europe or people who work from civil society can be useful to just import afterwards some of these methods. I think this is a much longer-term effect that is more difficult to point to, I guess, but that can be probably useful in a deeper way.
Back to you, Paul Pillar, to talk about what Benjamin referred to with respect to this event happening in the wake of the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, anti-Semitic attacks there, as well as in Denmark, and calling, you know, the threat, you know, as it is to some extent, you know, it's emanating from radical Islam, the distortion of Islam. And of course, President Obama goes way out of his way, just as his predecessor did, George W. Bush, saying that we are not, that is, the United States nor the West is at war with Islam, but the radical Islamists are at war with us. And if we call the threat coming from Islamist extremists, that we're distancing ourselves from Muslims whom we need as allies. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, a couple of thoughts, Carol. One, as always, here in Washington, you know, politics is involved. And so the line that the opponents of Mr. Obama use, that he is, you know, shying away from calling a spade and calling a threat what it really is just simply another talking point for a lot of people in terms of the overall theme of portraying the president as supposedly weak and so on. I don't want to get into that, but you have to remember that's always a big part of charges that are made here in Washington. I think the other point is to make a careful distinction between, on the one hand, you know, the sort of discussion that the three of us can have here or anyone else about the nature of the problem and the nature of the threat and in a very academic sort of way. And secondly, you know, what someone like the President of the United States, as well as other U.S. officials, have to be careful to avoid in terms of sending unintended messages to foreign parties. And I think it is very wise of this administration, and as you noted, the previous administration came to realize this as well, that certain terminology, however honest and direct it might seem to us in a discussion among people who are not President of the United States, would have a negative effect overseas in terms of how the U.S. is perceived, what its intentions are perceived as, that the country would be perceived as taking sides in sectarian or religious-based conflicts, which would not be in U.S. interest at all.
Turning back to you, Benjamin Haddad, I think it's interesting also to note that many participants, many of the Muslims in this conference, were willing to say, you know, we have a problem within the Muslim world to some extent, that they are willing to address the problem, whether it's the distortion of the faith by extremists for violent ends, for political ends. Do you see any efforts in that regard, attempts to combat the perversion of Islam within the Muslim community around the world?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I totally understand Professor Pillar's point, but it is necessary, I think, to call what it is by its name. The point is not to make a broad argument about Islam or making generalization that would be obviously wrong politically and intellectually between Islam and terrorism. But there is an internal battle, intellectual battle within the Islamic world that a lot of Islamic clerics and the majority of them actually acknowledge and want to fight over the interpretation of the holy text. The question is it helpful for these people who are trying to promote a more moderate and enlightened interpretation of their holy text to claim that this has nothing to do with Islam? Or on the contrary, should we try to promote these views, these voices, as the legitimate stronger voice within Islam today? A lot of clerics, for example, in France are making that case and are working on this, saying our texts are being hijacked by extremists who do refer to actual verses and actual parts of the Quran that can be interpreted in a very ambiguous way, and they're fighting back and trying to make the case for a more enlightened view. I think our task should be to promote these voices as much as possible.
Indeed, and we note that President Obama said a few weeks ago, in no way justifying the violence committed in the name of Islam as adherents of ISIL, or the Islamic State as it's also known. He mentioned historically how Christians also killed in the name of the faith, you know, the Catholic Church, I mean, the Inquisition, and of course other events. Every faith has its militants who do things. Again, this isn't to excuse or apologize for what's going on today, but I think it's important to put things in perspective.
Well, you're making a reference to the speech that the president made at the National Prayer Breakfast earlier this month. I thought it was an excellent speech. He took a lot of criticism from people who did not like the idea of having their own faith, be it the Christian faith in particular, somehow seen as, in their view, made equivalent to what's going on in the more extreme sectors of Islam. But that's not what the president was saying at all. One of his main points in that speech was a call for humility and saying that, you know, regardless of what your faith is, or even if you are unchurched, not believing that you have all the right answers is an appropriate attitude. I would just add also, and I agree with Ben, that the voices of moderate authorities in the world of Islam are extremely important to be heard. And to the extent that things can be done quietly to encourage their influence, that's all to the good. And I think it gets right to the purpose of what this conference this week was all about. But we need to realize there are severe limitations in what the United States can do here. And it is not up to the United States, and the United States government certainly would be a very poor messenger here to tell people in the Middle East or elsewhere, you know, how to interpret the holy texts of their religion. Somebody else is going to have to do that, and not the U.S. government.
But in a way, that's already what they're saying, but they're saying it has nothing to do with Islam. I think that's the irony of it, is that the president and this administration are acting as interpreters of the holy text, saying this has nothing to do with Islam, this is un-Islamic. So they are already making a sort of religious argument about this that is not necessarily the one that moderate voices around the world want to hear. It's not necessarily reinforcing them. A lot of Muslim clerics in Europe are perfectly fine with saying that this has to do with a radical branch of Islam that they're trying to fight and they're trying to overcome. Now, I do agree absolutely with Professor Pillow that it's not necessarily the U.S. role, and U.S. authority can be, you know, very limited in what it can do in that respect within that internal divide in Islam. But it's very important not to forget the ideological dimension of it. This week at this summit, a lot of attention was focused on education, social roots, economic roots, and all of this is extremely important. But a lot of the jihadi fighters or the authorities in radical groups are sometimes educated, come from actually pretty wealthy backgrounds. There is an ideological dimension that maybe in Europe and the United States is more difficult to comprehend because we've overcome, I think, the religious dimension in our polities, but we shouldn't underplay it, and we should not underestimate the impact they can have in political and individual decisions that are made by these radical groups.
We'll be talking about the ideological and political dimension in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Paul Pillar. He's professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, formerly a longtime analyst in the U.S. intelligence community, and Benjamin Haddad, from whom you just heard. He's research fellow in European and transatlantic affairs at the Hudson Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. We're talking about the politics and substance of the White House Conference to Counter Violent Extremism. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a longtime listener from Lagos, Nigeria, Michael Umagun. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with comments and feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Professor Pillar. And let's take a look at the ideological and political dimension. And I'm not sure to what extent this was discussed at this summit, but certainly I think many would argue that underlying these violent actions by Al-Qaeda or the self-described Islamic State and other militant Islamist groups are real grievances. And, for example, you look at Iraq and Syria. For example, you have former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who was arguably oppressing members of the Sunni community. He was cracking down on them. One could say, well, you know, that's sort of the root of the problem. And then to such an extent that they would prefer siding with or going along with ISIL, who was opposing, you know, Maliki and the regime, than, you know, fighting ISIS or ISIL. So again, I mean, this isn't to in any way defend ISIL, what they're doing, but the United States, the West, has a role to play in helping to prevent the violence that we're seeing. Now, it's one thing, military action, as Secretary Kerry said and President Obama said, is certainly necessary. We are striking ISIL. We are trying to convene a coalition to combat ISIL. But again, it's not enough. What about other measures to prevent some of these regimes, whether it's Nouri al-Maliki, now we have a new government. But again, even Abadi, he's one man, and instilled some of the same irritants that have led the Sunni community to either side with ISIL or not combat them.
One of the key points that Mr. Obama made in his own remarks to the conference, and it's really a point that the previous administration and President Bush expressed, and I think it's a valid point, is indeed that the political and economic freedoms or lack thereof and opportunities or lack thereof in many of the countries we're talking about are an important factor that affect the attractiveness or lack of it of a group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. I think there's no question about that. And you're quite right what you just said in terms of some of the political dynamics in Iraq, that when you have one community, say the Sunni community in Iraq, that feels disenfranchised, relatively speaking, compared to who's in power in Baghdad, and this was certainly the case with Mr. Maliki, as you mentioned, that when there's a perception of no other channel for pressing one's grievances and trying to stick up for one's own community, then the attractiveness of a group like ISIL, as mean and brutal as it is still there. So that is a valid point. I think one of the tensions here that some of the commentators who are listening to the conference this week have noted is that, well, on the one hand, you have that whole dimension that you and I have just discussed, but you also still have, you know, a real hard security need to use either military force or police measures to counter an armed group like ISIS. And some of our friends and allies and cooperators on the counterterrorist front are some pretty undemocratic and some pretty harsh regimes. One notes, you know, the prominent role played by, say, the Egyptian government, Mr. el-Sisi, which, quite frankly, has been taking a very hardcore authoritarian turn and a turn away from democracy. And, you know, you can argue out exactly where that balance should be struck in a place like Egypt. But my point is simply there is a tension there, and I think U.S. officials recognize that there is a tension.
Turning to you, Benjamin Haddad, to comment on this topic. I mean, for example, we talked about the need to reform Islam, that the Muslims have to take a look at their faith and how it's misinterpreted by extremists. But there are real political drivers for extremism that have very little to do with the faith at all. I mean, and so you have, for example, in Iraq, where a Sunni community feels under threat by a Shiite-dominated government, which is backed by Iran. And that then upsets Saudi Arabia because the Saudis and the Iranians obviously are rivals. The Saudis don't like the Iranians because of their adherence to Shiite Islam and for other reasons, obviously. So you have all these other factors. And then you say, you know, what is the West's role? Couldn't they have perhaps helped prevent the rise of these extremist groups by perhaps coming in earlier, not just militarily, but maybe trying to crack heads together politically? I remember reading about how Maliki was just basically attacking these Sunni strongholds. And maybe, you know, he felt as a Shiite, you know, that the Sunni, the minority Sunni community under Saddam Hussein, terribly repressed the Shiites. But again, two wrongs don't make a right. And had he perhaps tried to include them in the government, co-opt them, we would not necessarily be where we are today. But again, it's easy in retrospect. But these are some of the factors that led to the growth of groups like ISIL. And we haven't even mentioned yet Bashar al-Assad, who, of course, is also is backed by Iran, a Shiite-dominated country, and oppressing his predominantly Sunni citizens who have tried to rise up peacefully initially, but then felt that they needed to defend themselves against his violent attacks.
No, absolutely. I agree with everything you said. There is an interplay right now of different factors in the Middle East. It is a region that is in violent transition. If you take the situation in Iraq, the problem is that the sectarian nature of the state, especially the state that was established after the fall of Saddam Hussein, sort of forces everyone to come back to their initial community. And the way even the democratic system is based in Iraq is mostly based on community. There's very little incentive for a member of a community to reach out to a member of another community because they're basically like, that way. I agree with everything that's been said on Maliki, but I think even beyond the personal dimension of Maliki, the way the system is set up right now is a strong incentive for a sectarian competition. And so that's also one of the drivers for the Sunnis to try to reach out to the Sunni majority in Syria and reach groups like ISIL and try to raise the borders, because it's also a way to, you know, not go from being a minority in Iraq to being a majority in two countries that could be brought together. So there is this interplay. And as you mentioned, obviously, the competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran that is very strong in the region. But, you know, I'd like to go even broader than that, if you allow me, because the problem is that the terrorist attacks that have been striking European soil this last month came from a homegrown terrorism. And people who have not been fighting in Syria and Iraq, that is one of the very interesting things. For example, if you look at the Charlie Hebdo attacks, there's been this legitimate focus these last couple years from French and European intelligence services on French and European fighters that go to fight in Syria and Iraq and potentially come back. We estimate them at about 1,000 right now. We don't really know how many of them are still radicalized, or on the contrary, how many of them are just disillusioned with their brutal experience in the region. But when you look at the profile of the Kouachi brothers and Amedi Coulibaly, these are actually older people than the profiles of the young, like 16, 17, 18-year-olds who go to fight in Syria. They're in their mid-30s. They went to jail already. They were radicalized a long time ago. And they're actually with a radical identity that is much deeply entrenched than the kids who are sometimes just psychologically lost who go to fight in Syria. So my point is, this is a challenge that is on multiple fronts. That's also what makes this summit a bit, I wouldn't say disappointing, but you do have political issues in the Middle East. You have economic and social dimensions, lack of opportunity, extreme youth unemployment, for example, in most of the Middle East. But you also have identity issues that is linked to integration in Europe, that is linked maybe just to the thrill of looking for adventure and purpose and meaning and fighting the wrong fight, but thinking that you're looking for something to fight for. There's such a complex interplay on local and regional dimensions. I think it's going to be very complicated to just put everything in perspective in 3 days in a summit in D.C.
No, you're absolutely right. I want to get Paul Pillar to react to the economic dimension, particularly in Europe, the lack of integration, particularly in France, the problem with the Muslim community. We've seen it over the last decade, all kinds of protests, and some of the children of immigrants from Algeria, North Africa, don't feel attached. They're unemployed, and so they resort to these kinds of extreme measures. And it just seems, Paul Pillar, that with all due respect, and we'll talk about it a little wee bit about the social media tools and all kinds of special envoys that are being named. I don't mean to denigrate the fact that there's now at the Department of Homeland Security a special envoy for strategic counterterrorism, or a new person at the State Department who will counter violent extremism. I mean, all this is well and good, but the problems are so large. What about the economic dimension, particularly in Europe, as we see this homegrown terrorism as a result of disaffected youth and people who have been radicalized in prisons and so forth?
Well, I agree very much with the overall picture that Ben painted, in the sense that it's extremely complex and very difficult to generalize, and each case is different. I mean, the perpetrator of the recent incident in Denmark, for example, by all accounts was a drug-addicted street thug. And I think for that person, to the extent that Islam or a radical interpretation of Islam, you know, came into his life as some kind of justification, it was one particular justification or straw that he could grab onto, but I think it would be very misleading to describe that incident and that person's motivations in terms of some kind of deep-seated, you know, ideological drive. With others, it's much different. So it's a combination of ideas of economic circumstances, political circumstances. I think we have had in several of the European countries these long-standing issues of integration versus segregation of Muslim communities with foreign roots. The different European countries have taken different approaches. I mean, the British, for example, have tended to favor a sort of multicultural, let every community, you know, be its own thing, in contrast to the French emphasis on greater integration, and which has manifested itself in you know, limitations on wearing the veil, that sort of thing. I think the jury is still out on you know, whose approach is quite right, and the fact that we still have these incidents despite this assortment of governmental policies shows us that no one has come up with one answer, and I wouldn't expect any one answer precisely because it is such a multifaceted problem.
Well, Benjamin, since you're from France, has there been a change of direction with regard to how to deal with the homegrown problem? Because we know in the so-called banlieue, in the suburbs, that this is a problem. These communities are very segregated, that there's so much unemployment. Has there been a change of thought as to how to deal with them?
As Paul Pillar pointed out, the French tradition tends to be more Jacobin, we like to say, so more secular, focusing on civic assimilation, so trying not to decentralize too much to communities or multiculturalism the way the Brits or certain Scandinavian countries have done. Thus, you have, for example, the veil is banned in schools. But I think despite this tradition of secularism has sort of been eroded these last couple decades, actually, in France, due to, in certain places, it's becoming more and more complicated to defend the French identity, the French Republican principles, especially areas where you have considerable minorities, if not majorities, of immigrant or Muslim population. In schools, it's becoming harder and harder to teach things like the Holocaust, for example, or even biology classes. So this is a challenge that is not theoretical. It's actually a very concrete challenge for local officials and mayors. I think what happened after these attacks is that a lot of these issues that had been somewhat pushed aside because they're very hard to tackle because of political correctness, because most of the time these issues are hijacked by political extremists like the National Front on the extreme right that is running on them without giving any credible and inclusive solution to them. They've sort of been ignored by the political class. Now it's impossible to ignore them anymore. There is a new focus on the one hand on secularism and an inclusive French Republican model. On the other hand, a very strong statement on fighting radical elements. To give you an example, the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who's a socialist, in a couple days after the attacks, on the one hand talked about fighting radical Islam, but then a couple days afterwards he talked about a social apartheid in France, which is also extremely controversial, talking about entire neighborhoods, especially the banlieues, as you said, so the suburbs of Paris, that had been totally abandoned by the French Republic economically, socially, with huge proportions of youth unemployment, with schools that are being degraded. So I think there is this two-front approach on being extremely clear on the threat and the ideological dimension of it, and reinforcing families, community, mosque leaders to confront this, but also tackling the deeper social and economic issues.
So back to you, Paul Pillar. As you said initially, the measures have to be multifaceted. There are so many layers to combating violent extremism, and the political, ideological dimension is huge, as well as the economic, as Benjamin just said. And of course, then there's combating the so-called narrative. And of course, President Obama at this summit was promoting social media tools, trying to, again, combat the sophisticated use of social media by groups like IS and Al-Qaeda, who recruit youth through social media. So that's important. So as we close, basically your thoughts with regard to where this whole effort is going, if you're optimistic with what came of the summit and how the United States and the West is going to be able to confront this huge problem.
Well, I'm encouraged about the overall realization of the multifaceted and complex nature of it. This helps to beat back the simplistic explanations you often hear from one quarter or another. Oh, well, the key to defeat this kind of extremism is this, or the key is that. But this is not some struggle that's going to have some milestone that we're going to pass next year or 5 years from now where we can say, okay, we got this licked. We've talked about how many of the roots that are involved are really deeply entrenched in the political and economic systems of countries overseas, including developed countries, as you were just talking about. France in particular, and those are going to be with us for quite some time.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Paul Pillar, he's professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, and Benjamin Haddad, research fellow in European and Transatlantic Affairs at the Hudson Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jackson Witt, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.